This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Gaza's Ministry of Health has announced that Israel has killed more than 25,000 people since it began its latest assault on the Palestinian territory. The grim death toll comes as the International Court of Justice is drafting a preliminary verdict in a case brought by South Africa charging Israel of genocide. As we approach International Holocaust Remembrance Day on January 27th, my guest Shane Burley has written a new piece for Yes Magazine called Don't Let Zionists Weaponize Jewish Suffering, where he points out that Israeli officials and war supporters are ironically employing the same language and logic as past perpetrators of genocide, charging its victims of genocidal intentions to justify killing them first. Shane Burley is a writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon. He is the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, and Why We Fight, Essays on Fascism, Resistance, and Surviving the Apocalypse. He's also the editor of the newly published book, No Pasaran, Anti-Fascist Dispatches from a World in Crisis. And he has another book coming out in June on anti-Semitism being published by Melville House Books. Welcome to the program, Shane.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, when we think about Holocaust, International Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27th, this is a really important reminder and should have been exactly the reminder that the world needed, right? To warn against genocide, against mass killings based on people's ethnicities, but apparently, we haven't learned the lesson.
Yeah, one thing that's important about Holocaust memory is what we can carry from those experiences into the future. And like a lot of things with Jewish memory, these are not just lessons, but sort of mirrors that we can look back and say, how are we going to use these to make different choices in the future? How can that inform us now? How can we be connected with our ancestors and carry their legacy with us today? And that seems to be something that ends up being dropped from the conversation. When we look at Holocaust Remembrance Day, people are sometimes resistant to actually carry those lessons into the present or to think about it in present terms. And when that happens, we often lose the opportunity that memory gives us.
How did that playbook of accusing one's victims of genocidal intents, how did that get applied to Jews by Nazi Germany?
It happened in a couple of ways. The first thing is by kind of uniting the image of the Soviet communist with that of the Jew. Those things became indistinguishable in Nazi propaganda. Jews were set to be the sort of core of the communist movement, and then to look at Soviet crimes, Soviet war crimes, and publicize them as much as possible to say, look at what these people are going to do to you if they're able to get to you, if they're going to win, look what a communist occupation will end up looking like in these places. And we're going to have to take serious action to protect you from this. So, for example, they would dig up graves and then post lots of articles and newspapers publicizing what were very real atrocities that had happened from Soviet soldiers. But what they would do is try and make sure that that was ubiquitous in the conversation so that the kind of fear would pump through a lot of people, and then they would not just kind of allow for what became genocidal activity, but they would actually participate in it as a sort of safety mechanism, saying, look, these are the actual genociders that are coming for us. We're going to have to take serious action. We're going to have to go above and beyond. We're going to have to actually push down over old moral boundaries if we're going to keep ourselves safe from these tyrannical monsters that are coming.
And so, of course, some of this sounds very sadly familiar. You also give the example in your story of Indonesia, a slightly more recent example where you sort of see that same playbook as well. Can you go through that and give our audience a sense of how Indonesia used similar logic to justify its genocide?
Yeah, in the article I talked about, the documentary from 2013, The Act of Killing, that went back to a lot of the people from the mid-20th century sort of revolution that happened in Indonesia, basically an attack largely on the left. But when these sort of like far-right militias took action. They called everyone communists and basically presented them all as a really serious militant threat, and then engaged in a level of genocide that was really unprecedented, but then tried to coax people to participate by framing the communist threat as so dire that basically they had to be exterminated. There's no other way around it. And so you see these sort of clips from Indonesian television from years back that seem really surreal, where they're basically explaining their war crimes, the torture and killing of people that were largely civilians, and having people kind of go along with it under the kind of assumption that a lot of these things were necessary to keep people safe.
And so, how are we now seeing that same playbook being unrolled, being used today by Israeli authorities?
I mean, it's happening in a kind of multi-step process. So the first off is as the body count goes up and up and up in Gaza and people start to use the term genocide, there is an attack from those supporting Israel's war on the way that genocide is being used, the rhetoric of genocide. So they're attacking, saying, hey, people are redefining genocide. The real genocidal ones are Hamas, and then they're expanding that beyond the boundaries of Hamas proper into the Palestinian people as such, and saying they are actually engaged in the project of genocide. And there's a few sleight of hand that kind of, there's a bit of sleight of hand that kind of happens with this. So first off, they'll point to sort of decolonization or anti-Zionist rhetoric, like for example, for the phrase from the river to the sea, and say actually that is a claim of genocide. They want to ethnically cleanse Jews from the area. But that's not what those terms mean. That's not historically what those terms have meant. But what they're doing is combining several things. First off, pointing to Hamas atrocities. Second, then trying to expand that to the entire Palestinian people. And then to point to rather innocuous phrases and add extra meaning to them to make it appear as an almost universal genocidal project happening from Palestinians in the direction of Israeli Jews. And that's actually not the case, right? The death count is overwhelmingly of Gazans, of Palestinians, not of Israelis. And that's not just true in the last few months. That's true historically. It's true of the entire creation of Israel as a nation state that was built entirely on ethnic cleansing and expulsion. So what you're having to do is take reality and flip it upside down, saying that this kind of military action that everyone is now calling genocide is actually the response to genocidal intentions. It's the only thing that's possible to keep Israelis safe from the real genociders.
I want to pick up on what you said, that death toll has always been incredibly lopsided. You write in your story, the claim that Palestinians intend to commit genocide has been a staple in Israel since long before the October 7th attacks. And so I'm wondering if you can expand on that in thinking about how it has not been very difficult for Israeli officials to ramp up that claim since October 7th, because there was already that sort of cultural buy-in that Palestinians are intent on killing Israelis any chance they get.
Part of the Zionist self-conception is that Jewish safety requires a sort of ethnocratic, militarized state to protect Jews because basically Gentiles have proven themselves unwilling to accept Jews, and that we can point to things like the Holocaust that says that. So when Palestinians are now demanding, for example, a binational region or a region for all its residents, that undermines that sort of demographic supermajority that Israel believes is necessary to keep Jewish Israelis safe or Jews worldwide safe. And so that is seen in a way almost as para-genocidal. That's an attack on the protective capacity that Israel has created for its citizenry. It's hard for them to imagine the idea that everyone in the region could be in a democratic project together and then Jews would remain safe in that. That's not sort of, that's not given proper consideration there. So when they're pointing to these movements like the PLO or BDS and saying, like, look, they're attacking this very kind of ethnographic or ethno-nationalist project, this safety mechanism, what they're doing is de facto attacking Jews in that. And then they'll point to, either extreme examples or kind of like bad rhetoric from like certain parts of the Palestinian movement and say, look, this is what they really mean. What they're really after is ethnically cleansing Jews. And this is, if we listen to what the larger Palestinian movement has always said, that is not the case. And so what they're doing is willfully ignoring what these social movements have actually demanded because they want to maintain this idea that without these really extreme military solutions, they're not going to be able to keep any of the people in the region safe. And then that extends to world Jewry, that Jews at large aren't going to be safe because they no longer have this kind of militarized safety net.
It seems as though if Israel is using this same playbook that was used against Jews, that other perpetrators of genocide have used against their victims, that unfortunately we, you know, have such a grim way of seeing that ultimately human beings are all the same, regardless of our religious background, that we can be subject to both victimization and perpetration of genocide. And that, you know, this idea of the specialness of the chosen people is really something that it feels like we need to be challenging, right?
I think that there is this assumption that Jewish folks having experienced this historic trauma would walk away with particular lessons from that. And frankly, that's not how trauma works. You know, a lot of times when we experience trauma, we actually create a loop of that trauma. We repeat those traumas. We mm-hmm. participate in those as well. And so I think it's important to note that folks who have experienced these kind of historic genocides like the Holocaust are people like anyone else who have the same kind of baggage that they carry in with them. And so we have to sort of push through that from a universal perspective. We have to kind of be able to take that step back and say, like, what's actually taking place here? And, you know, when we have something like Holocaust memory or Holocaust remembrance, we have the opportunity to kind of look back into that history and see that what we can carry now. And I think that's actually an important piece of Jewish tradition, is looking at our past and figuring out what lessons they have now. But that's an intentional process we have to go through. It's not one that sort of just comes naturally just because of those experiences. So I think when we were talking about how to sort of memorialize the day, I think it's about intentionally looking back and saying, what can we learn from those experiences? What can we bring those up into the present? And how can we project those into a universal framework? How can we project that to the rest of the world and think about how we can make different decisions now?
What do you think about the International Court of Justice case that South Africa has brought, charging Israel with genocide? Do you think that is an important moment for, you know, sort of global society to think about, and the global community to think about, how we break this cycle, how we challenge this playbook, and really commit to this idea of never again?
I think it's always important to name genocide when it's genocide. And I think having international collaboration, having a country like South Africa really come forward in the International Criminal Court is a real positive development. But I also think it's important to look at how, for example, the US plays a really particular role in this. And that's where I think the most important change needs to happen. Because when other countries confront Israel, it has not historically made the difference that, for example, the USA would make in that, which is why you're seeing such a large Palestinian solidarity movement in the USA. They basically confront US complicity in the genocide, particularly funding and sending the arms and things like that. So while I think it's important, particularly rhetorically, but also just for sending the message, I think it's still not where we need to be to put the kind of pressure we need to actually stop this.
So finally, Shane, I'm wondering whether you have any thoughts to share as we approach Holocaust Remembrance Day on January 27th, because even as Israel is using the playbook of the genocide perpetrators, it's not as if anti-Semitism has gone away.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, as I write in the piece, I historically don't particularly like the politicalization of Holocaust Remembrance Day. I think it's important. The Holocaust is a distinctly Jewish event. I think it should be remembered as such in certain ways. But I also think that right now it brings up a question about what anti-Semitism and oppression, what kind of strategies we actually have to fight them. And I think historically looking and finding Jews in solidarity with other marginalized folks or other folks facing oppression, that is what has kept Jews historically safe, not militarism, certainly not nationalism. And so that's one of the lessons I take when looking back at the Holocaust, of what my ancestors experienced in Nazi Germany and the surrounding areas, is that it was actually solidarity with everyone who was targeted that kept them safe. And that's the lesson I want to bring today, is that having this one-sided nationalist project is not what has actually have the track record of Jewish safety. So as we see anti-Semitism rise, and it is rising, I think we need to look a different direction for how we're going to fight this. And the only way we're going to successfully fight this is if we create an alliance of other people targeted by the nationalist riot, by Christian nationalism, by U.S. imperialism.
There is a change, though, right? Especially among young Jewish folks. There's a huge percentage of young Jewish folks that are protesting the Israeli attack on Gaza. In fact, are taking the lead in those protests here in the United States, a fact that rarely makes it into the headlines of our mainstream news.
Absolutely. Palestinian solidarity organizing in the U.S. is very, very Jewish. And part of it is that a lot of young Jews are forging a different path for their Jewish tradition and Jewish identity than some of the other organizations they may have grown up with, that they might feel uncomfortable with now or alienated from. And so people are building a really strong sense of community on that universalist ethos, what we call safety through solidarity. And that, I think, is not just becoming politically powerful. It's actually changing Jewish life in really, really wonderful ways.
Shane, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link from your story on our website. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much.
My guest has been Shane Burley. He's a writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon, and the author of numerous books, including Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, Why We Fight, Essays on Fascism, Resistance, and Surviving the Apocalypse. He's also the editor of No Pasaran, Anti-Fascist Dispatches from a World in Crisis, and he's a new book coming out that is focused on anti-Semitism being published by Melville House Books. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.